purpose now is to take a step back and since you've seen an example of all the things going on in climate rules, just step back and abstract the rules. So, you know, we've always, the bottom line is we're calculating S-matrix elements. And we're using this basic formula, minus B. And then you're, we're interested in matrix elements of that between initial and final states. And it's all to do with the creation of annihilation operator algebra, right? These things are particle states. And these things are expressed in terms of fields. So you've got V is an integral d3x of some local functional of fields and the derivatives of the fields and so on. And the fields are given in terms of, you know, if you have some index in the field, some of our spins, integral p3k, normalization functions, and then there's a some wave function of some kind which carries the spin of the, you know, the tensorial structure of the field. It's a creation operator, or a destruction operator. Then there's typically some conjugate, complex conjugate part if we have a real field, which we might as well take. So the bottom line is that this is just a complicated way of writing a bunch of creation annihilation operators, for which you're taking matrix elements whose evaluation is calculable given the properties of creation and annihilation operators. So you're just doing this over and over and over again, and it becomes algebraically cumbersome. It's probably go down the series, you know, the more things you have to worry about, the more different ways that a particular destruction operator can destroy a particular particle in the final state, or there might be various particles that are give a whole bunch of interactions. Particles in the second interaction might be created and then they're destroyed by the second interaction. And keeping track of all those things becomes cumbersome. And the Feynman graphs, the Feynman rules are just a mnemonic for writing down the amplitude you get from the creation and annihilation operator algebra. And if you ever forget a rule, that's how you rederive it, is you go back and ask, you know, what was the creation and annihilation operator algebra? And so, so what are the rules? Typically, you know, the graph the idea is that you just draw a line for the process of when a particle is created and a particle is destroyed, which is essentially what happens. There's two scenarios, right? You either create a particle at one interaction and destroy it at another interaction, or you have a particle that was always there in the initial state, gets destroyed by somebody in one of the interactions, or there's a particle that was always in the final state, which is created by something in one of the interactions, or it might have been just something in the final state, might have been in the initial state. But the mnemonic is you just draw a line for the particle's evolution in time, which starts when it's created and destroys when it stops when it's destroyed. So you can decide which way time goes. And there's two classes of people, some of whom go left to right because that's the way you write. Some of them go right to left because that's the way matrix elements run. So let's do it that way, right to left. So time is running that way. So you just have a bunch of particles coming in. These are all the guys that are in state alpha. A bunch of particles coming out. These are all the particles that are in state beta. I guess I'll write it as a bra, just besides the final state. And then there's a bunch of interactions, which are all characterized by properties of this interaction in the Lagrangian. So they're all characterized that they're associated with field localized to the point. So let's say they're. There might be n of these, n interactions. And each of those things has some number of fields that can, in them, each of which can degrade or destroy a particle. They're all associated with lines converging. The number of lines would correspond to the number of fields in that interaction. We've been looking at things that have three fields, so that would be stuff like this. But you can imagine looking at things more than three fields. And then the amplitude corresponds to all possible ways of connecting these lines with these lines. And for every possible way of connecting them, you write down a number, and you add them all up. Because you have to sum all possible ways in which the creation and annihilation operators could have destroyed particles. And there are certain factors that are always arising repeatedly, which you encode in the rules. And there's certain factors that are associated with each of these things is associated with a position, because they're all associated with a Lagrangian, ultimately. So on. And so you integrate over all the x's, and you have factors associated with each of these lines, which are associated with keeping track of these kind of factors that were there in the field coefficients. And so we saw that when you had one of these particles come in and get destroyed by something, there was an overall factor of the wave function which went along and appeared in the amplitude for that. And the same thing was true here, that if we had a particle being created, that it had a wave function factor which kind of came along for the ride, because of the it was being created by some field in an interaction with Lagrangian, and then that was it. Like something was just created and destroyed between two particles. We had this whole story as to how when you summed over the possible states that could be appearing in between here, that gave us a propagator, which was a tensor of some sort. And so there's an explicit kind of a rule that we got. And when we integrated over all the positions, it was useful to take, you're always doing integrals of e to the I k-axis, so you're doing a Fourier transform at some level. And so it was useful to do those integrals explicitly to get an answer which is in the momentum space, and then that's typically where you quote the rules. And so let me just state the rules, because you've seen it a couple times, and it's just a matter of being explicit about what they were. And where they come from is coming from this, always coming from this creation and annihilation operator algebra for creating and destroying particles. So it's just a matter of being, not being clever, but being a good bookkeeper. You know, you just have to follow all the numbers and make sure that you keep track of them. So in the standard model, there's three kinds of things, right? There's spin 0, a half, and 1. And so there, that's going to correspond to three kinds of lines. So a spin 0 line I'm going to draw like that. It'll have momentum flowing along it. And so if it's an external line, so these are, what should we call the external lines? A line that connects, say, two vertices like this would be an internal line. And you know that they correspond to different factors because we saw it explicitly in the mu and the k case. And these are, again, external lines. And these are the vertices. So the external lines, well, let me just so the rules that go with external lines. So if you have a, so I'm imagining there's some graph here, and I'm following a final state external line, so spin 0. So in the final state, you have something like that. There's other things going on. Then that factor corresponds to the momentum phase factor of 1. And so for an initial state, it's the same kind of thing. And that's because for a scalar field, these u's are basically 1. The e to the I kx's would have been there, but those have been done by doing the integrals over x. So I'm putting in the answer after doing the integrals over x along the lines of the example I did. And there's factors of 2 pi energies, which I'm giving you the relativistic rule. So I'm giving you the conventions where those 2 pi energies are not being carried along for each line. So for spin half, there were two situations. There's a particle or an antiparticle in the initial and final state. So the particle I'm going to denote by having the arrow flow in the direction of time. In principle, there could have been, there was a momentum that was flowing here, right, which I didn't draw, but then did draw. And I'm going to draw that separately here too, because the arrow showing you the direction of momentum flow is not the arrow I'm drawing here. This is the thing that's distinguishing a particle from an antiparticle. So this is the initial particle, or final, sorry, final particle. And this would be a final antiparticle, again, for which the momentum would be flowing in the same direction. I didn't make the distinction here because it's all one. So, and then we could have, for the initial state, we could have had a similar thing. We have an initial particle coming in with the momentum p. So I'm running out of things to space to write here. So the initial particle, remember the particles always came along with a, for a spinner, there was a U appeared here, and there was a V spinner that appeared here. So the antiparticles are always going to be associated with the V spinners. Particles will be U spinners. Now, if the particle, supposing this had been a spinner field, and we had an initial particle, then the way that it would arise, is it, at some point, it's going to be destroyed. So for an incoming particle, we're going to ask for it to hit a destruction operator, which can come with the field. For a particle, that'll come with the field, psi as opposed to psi bar, because that's the destruction piece. So what we should be expecting is that an incoming particle is going to come associated with a spinner U. And conversely, a final state particle had to be a creation term. You get creation terms when you complex conjugate that, that's when you have a psi bar. So for a final state particle, you're going to get a factor of U bar P. For antiparticles, it's similar, but you have to keep track of this thing. And remember, this has got a creation piece in it. So the field psi creates particles. That will be associated with the final state. So here we're going to get V, V. And this is, the initial thing had to be destroyed. So that comes, corresponds with a complex conjugate of psi. So that would be a V bar. For spin 1, it was the same kind of story, but it was polarization vectors appeared rather than spinners. And essentially, the in that case, remember there was a polarization vector and its complex conjugate. And so the particle and the antiparticle, in both cases, the destruction is the polarization vector and the creation is the complex conjugate of the polarization vector. So I don't need to make the separate distinction between U and V. So if we have an incoming particle or antiparticle, P, that would correspond to, this is being created, so it's going to correspond to the complex conjugate polarization vector. And the initial one, and the draw a wavy line. And the corresponding. So you see that the polarization vector comes with an index mu because the field kind of was a vector field. And so it's, you can sometimes in a Feynman graph you actually label that with a mu. You don't have to, but it's sometimes you see that. And the same thing could have been done for the spinner. The spinner, the U's and the V's were a column spinner in Dirac space, so they have a, you could think of them as having a label I going from 1 to 4, which I could have put on the end of those lines. Right, so far so good. And I managed to get that back for the time. So in the book, we've got the other way around. So did I get that right? So the guy who's destroyed is epsilon. And that should have been this guy, right? That should have been complex conjugate. It's a type of both there. 5.51 should have been an epsilon rather than epsilon star. Oh, I hope we go times was left to right for stuff like this. That could I do the same way as the book. Okay. All right, so that's external lines. That's easy. Internal lines. So that's going to correspond to I'm going to have a field at both ends, right? There's some interaction point at both ends. And so there was a field in the interaction point. These things were labeled by the properties of the particle that was called here. So P and sigma are what was appearing here. Right? And the mu you can think of as being attached to the other end. That's where the field is going. For internal lines, they're not going to be labeled by momentum because the two ends of the line corresponded to a vertex which created and destroyed the particle, and that's labeled by a position. But once we integrate over position, the positions are gone, but it's going to be labeled by the field index rather than a spin index. So for a scalar field, in zero, there we have there's momentum flowing through that line P, and there's a convention for, which I'm going to screw up with a check it, this is not my original convention. So in a momentum space, you've got minus I, plus I, integral, before P, I, fourth, 1 over P squared. So the momentum here is not a property of the amplitude we're calculating, whereas the momentum here was one of the initial and final momenta of the problem, so that you didn't integrate over it because it was a part of the answer. This momentum is something which is something which you remember we saw is arising because of we're inserting a complete set of states here and then summing over all possible things that could have been there. And then there's that trick which took the step functions and made them into energy integrals. And so that process is giving us an integral in momentum space over all over the four momentum that's appearing in here, which is what that factor is. So spin a half is similar. So it's going to be labeled by, so let's say a particle, the reason that I'm going to become clear in a second, I'm going to have the momentum I'm going to draw going opposite to the direction of the fermion number flow. So if this is an antiparticle moving forward, carrying momentum P when I'm drawing this, the relative direction of these things is going to be important because whereas this is even if the P goes to minus P, the fermion thing is not going to be even enough. So at each end, what destroyed or created this particle was a spinner. So I should expect there to be a spinner matrix I and J here, corresponding to the fields that created and destroyed the spinner. And so and the factors that the minus I and the 2 pi to the 4 of the integral are universal. Minus I P slash plus M P squared. And remember, so P slash, remember, this is kind of the loop. So it's a. And in these conventions, so the book is actually giving you the conventional momentum goes with the arrow. The way to remember this is that let me come back here about it in a second. Now this is a matrix. Yeah, this is just a number, but this part of it is a matrix. And so we're supposed to be reading the. Let me make sure I get this right. The way I've drawn this, we're reading this matrix. Ij. We go it down. So the Fermi number is done that way. So this is an antiparticle one, but I'm going to destroy the psi bar. It's looking better over here, so that's an EJI. So what you'll notice is that I've drawn the, it was going from J to I, but the matrix in Dirac space is I to J. It's going along the direction of the Fermion number flow, I to J. But that sounds funny to me, so let me just put it through again. So we have antiparticle coming in. I destroy it with a sine bar. You see, this is what you need in order to make the psi bars and the u bars and the u's just come out into a to contract properly. That's kind of where you're trying to remember where the i's and j's go. Spin one is a similar story. And we have a momentum flow in that direction. It's not so important to keep track of the fields are here labeled by mu and nu because those are there was a field that created destroyed this particle the same way this was had a Dirac label. So this is one design. This is the one we did explicitly. And the expression I'm giving you here is the one that we had in unitary gauge. Sorry. You remember that when we looked at the Lagrangian and we made a choice for get rid of the freedom to do gauge transformations at one point. And that choice carried along to this point. And so when I did the calculation that gave you this, that had been done in a particular gauge. And I'm just reminding you that it was a unitary gauge. If you'd done it in a different gauge, there's a whole variety of other things you could have gotten here. And so in particular, say, just to give you an example of other gauges, so some other gauge choices. So Feynman gauge the corresponding propagator would have been A to mu nu over P squared plus M squared times by epsilon. So you don't have this last term. And there's another one which is called Landau gauge. It has the property that the numerator is zero when you contract it with P mu, so it's A to mu nu minus P mu P squared. Then there's a relative C gauge, it's called. Or sometimes it's called Fujikawa Lee Sanda gauge, if you're of a certain age. And it interpolates between these various gauges. So it's A to mu nu plus C minus 1. This particular gauge is in the appendix. Oh, I almost had it. I didn't need to go to run. If I've done this right, then if C is equal to 1, that's Feynman gauge. So that kills this whole term. You just have that. If C is equal to 0, that should be Landau gauge. So that kills that. C is equal to 0, then you've got that. That's right. If C goes to infinity, that should be unitary gauge. C goes to infinity, then you can forget the minus 1, and you can keep this term, and then you just get P mu P mu over M. So it's very often useful to work in this. You see, the reason that people think about these different gauges is there's two reasons. One is that you're often interested, for the purposes of the, down the road, one of the problems with calculating in quantum field theory is you have these ultraviolet convergences. We're doing a lot of integrals over d4p, and we're interested in how the integrals we get converge or not as p goes to infinity. And that's the thing that's going to make it converge is that it's just going to turn out is the only thing that's going to make things small for large p are these propagators, which are going to be 1 over p squared for large p. But this one doesn't go like 1 over p squared for large p, because this numerator goes like p squared, and this cancels goes p squared. So although this and this, this goes like 1 over p, this goes like 1 over p squared, this actually goes like p to the 0 for large p. And that makes it actually very inconvenient for thinking about graphs that have loops and so have integrals in them. Whereas that's much more convenient, because for any c that's not infinity, this p squared takes this p squared to 1, and then this p squared takes everything going to infinity. It makes the whole propagator go like 1 over p squared. And so that, for understanding issues of renormalizability, these kind of gauges are much more convenient than the unitary gauge was. The unitary gauge is very convenient for just reading off the mass of the things in the Lagrangian, like we did. But for tree graphs, it's perfectly good. But when you do loop graphs and you have to worry about how integrals converge, then these kind of gauges are more convenient. This is more normally very convenient because it's very simple. This is actually very convenient because it helps you catch errors in your calculation. Because varying C just changes gauges, once you finish your answer, C has to cancel in the answer. So if you calculate something like a cross section, if you find at the end of the day that C is still in the answer, that means you screwed up somewhere because nothing physical can depend on what gauge you use to calculate it. And so it's useful to keep the C around just so you can check that it appeared that it drops out the answer the other day.
So when was it that we made these gauge choices? Is this like the beginning of?
The very, very, very beginning when I wrote down, we wanted to have a Lagrangian that was recognizable as a free particle.
Also just the changing of the field, redefinition of fields then? Is that the
right around then, but when we had a spin one for the Higgs part of the Lagrangian, d mu phi, dagger, d mu phi. And inside here, there were pieces which looked like, this was d mu phi, psi, a alpha mu, some matrix, times phi, dagger. And then the cross terms, there's a d mu phi, a term. And so when we shifted it, phi was some background value plus curly phi, where this was the background value for the back, we chose that to be 0 b over 2 or something like that. If you take this background value, the derivative always kills it because it was a constant, but there's cross terms now. In general, there's a cross term between a derivative of curly phi, this is a background phi, and a, so I have a phi cross terms. And that was something which was hard to interpret as a particle because it wasn't spin 0, it wasn't spin 1, it was something mixing the spin 1 and spin 0.
Okay, so it's just the Higgs field that you were changing that to.
That's where it came up for us, but if we had no Higgs field, if we're doing electrodynamics, then we still have to choose a gauge. Okay. It's not clear from anything I've said so far, but you always have to choose a gauge for the spin 1 particle. And so in our case, we recognized that we had this freedom to redefine the fields, which is a symmetry, just this gauge invariance. And so we just made it convenient by choosing it to kill this cross term. And that made it pretty obvious what the particle content was. And that's the unitary gauge choice. But if we, another thing you can do is you can add to the Lagrangian something which is, the thing you would do to get the one of those gauges would be to add something like 1 over c, d mu, a alpha, plus some constant t alpha phi or something like that. I guess it'd be finite transpose t alpha phi squared, and add that to the Lagrangian. That ruins the gauge invariance too. And if you actually work out the quadratic, you can choose this coefficient in such a way to kill the cross term between a and d phi. And so then you can also get something where you can see that there's a vector propagator, there's a scalar propagator, if they don't mix it with each other. And that actually gives you this gauge here. This c turns into that c. And so Landau gauge corresponds to the case where you kind of made this through a delta function. And that's why it satisfies div a equals 0, basically, and that's kind of why it's 0 when you hit it with p mu. And Feynman gauge corresponds to just taking this equal to 1, so you just have this. And they all have their relative merits for different calculations.
I've been wanting to ask you this question for quite some time. Why do we never discuss anti-symmetric tensor fields? Where did Bloom come up?
In the standard model, why don't they come up?
They come up in...
In the standard model, they don't come up. So I was able to show you the whole model without them, and that's why I didn't have some.
But like in Moffat's theory, in gravity theory.
Well, antimatter tensor fields come up a lot in supergravity. But in four dimensions, it turns out that an antisymmetric tensor with two indices is a change of variables of a scalar field. You can think of it as a scalar field. It's a special case in the scalar field with no potential. So there's no loss of generality of not talking about antisymmetric tensors. But it comes up normally in supergravity theories anyway, because in that case, even though it's true you could write in terms of a scalar field, what happens is that the supersymmetry transformation rules happen to look simple. They naturally take you to an antisymmetric tensor way of thinking things rather than a scalar field. And the equivalence of a scalar field with an antisymmetric tensor is specific to four dimensions. If you're in six dimensions, an antisymmetric tensor is equivalent to something else, and it's actually another antisymmetric tensor. And so if you do supergravity in n dimensions, you're always getting antisymmetric tensors and not things that are equivalent to any dimension. You can make it equivalent to something else, but it naturally comes to an antisymmetric tensor. So in four dimensions in general, in the standard model picker, you're not losing anything by not having antisymmetric tensors. In Moffat's theory in particular, so this is where it can like come off, but there's strong, whenever you do gravity, there's strong issues of, the argument I gave in the standard model, one of the arguments was that if you had a massless spin one particle, it had to couple the gauge very well. And that's, it's very restrictive, like how you couple massless or very light particles to things. And I think a fair statement is that so it's known how to couple a massless spin one particle, a massless spin three halves particle, and a massless spin two particle in four dimensions. And an antisymmetric tensor is known how to couple because it's a scalar field in disguise. But that once you start fooling with couplings of scalars and things to gravity, then it's very difficult to arrange for the energy to be causal problems. And I know John has had a series of theories. It depends on when you asked what his theory was, and then I've had conversations with him around for 20 years, for which it wasn't always true that he had an energy which is not in Coulomb's phase. So the Motherhood things that I listed at the very beginning of the class are generically not satisfied by modification of gravity that we've got in cosmology. And I don't know what his last version of these consistent goes down, but
he's tinkered with it a little bit. He has. If you turn into a massive spin one field, you can get energy that are not by that level. But it's pretty. He's added a lot in terms to his company.
Yeah, and you really want to. It's very slippery exactly where the damage goes, because you can sometimes make it look like the energy is okay, but you've hidden it somewhere else because some variables, some things are clear, and other variables, other things are clear, and everything's not clear on the same set of variables now. So, and this is probably completely unfair, but given the 20 years of history, I'm skeptical that that's a consistent theory of gravity, to the extent that it's different than just a scalar tensor theory of gravity. I think at the end of the day, once it becomes consistent, a fair statement is that there's no conclusive. The only theories for which it's been shown that the modifications of gravity are consistent in the longest limit are the scalar tensor vector theories, and also then the Fermionic partners would be spin three halves and spin half. And I think that's not to say there won't be other things that are consistent, but I think that none of the other theories have shown that they've been consistent. And there's many people who tried and then failed. And many more people who have half-heartedly tried and then didn't fail because they didn't actually get the end. And so where exactly various theories fit in, I'm not really sure, but I think that there's no generally agreed example that's not in that class of scalar tensor vector theories.
Excuse me, can I just ask another question?
Yeah.
I asked you this morning about this first order form of...
Yeah.
Have you seen how this is quantized at all, or I just want to know? I just know that it is possible to do.
It depends on the theory. I think the first quantized version I know is often useful for showing specific kinds of things. That's the way I'm used to seeing it. So if you want to show, actually, for instance, the duality between the equivalence of an expander tensor in a scalar field is actually easier to show in the first derivative kind of a form, because you can set it up as a path integral where you can do the integral because it's first quantized. If it's things in the field involved are not constrained in the way that they would be if you had been doing things in terms of, say, field strength, or so the curl of strength. And so,
but there are some lines associated with these auxiliary fields, right? Anti-symmetric fields. The internal lines, external lines.
Yeah.
There should be a solution, but we never observed these particles.
No, that's also true with these. So when I tell you the C gauge, the skim, the vector propagator could look like this, there's other things that happen in these gauges too, which I haven't told you about, which are in the appendix, but which are also there. And that's, for instance, the, you know, in the unitary gauge, the way we killed the cross term was we actually set three of the components of phi to zero. So there's no propagator for them at all. So the only scalar field that can appear in these rules for the standard model is just the physical Higgs. But if we don't do that, and we choose some other gauge like this, then really all four components of Higgs are there. So there's actually internal lines for all four components of Higgs, including the ones that are eaten by the W bosons, really. And so you never see those as external lines because they come to you as the longitudinal W and Z boson. But in graphs, you have lines corresponding to the propagation of these unphysical scalars because of the gauge term. And then in order to get the same answer, something else has to also be there, because you know the answer can't depend on C, and I've just introduced a whole bunch of graphs that you didn't have in the other cases. And what happens is that if you're careful about if you actually derived, stick this thing in a controlled way, and not just say I'm just going to modify the variable, you can actually derive how to put this thing in a way which is equivalent. You start off with a theory of unitary gauge, and you do a transformation in the field which takes you this. And that also gives you, in addition to these extra scalars, it gives you what are called ghosts, which they propagate in loops, and they have negative statistics. And their job is essentially to go through and cancel the effects of all these physical scalars they're running around.
It's really a machinery.
It's really a machinery, right. And I'm not describing properly the C gauge at all. I'm just in passing telling you that in the gauge, this particular thing looks like this. This is all the time it runs on describing how modifications in the early appendix, which you have to be careful of. So the real way to do it is that this is where the path integral thing is a better way to think about things, because you can just take the starting point. The logic of quantizing gauge theory is this, that you find a gauge where the physical content of the theory is obvious, like a unitary gauge, but then things like the Lorentz invariance and renormalizability are not. And then you explicitly do a change of variables to one of the other gauges where renormalizability and Lorentz covariance is obvious, but it's not, unitary is not obvious because you've got all these ghosts of funny things flying around. And the fact that they're the same is because gauge invariance was there. You've got in one gauge, one thing's obvious, another gauge, another thing's obvious, but because the whole thing's gauge invariant, then both things are true. And that's another way of seeing why, if you didn't have gauge invariance, you're in trouble in these high spin theories, because you have to give up Lorentz invariance or unitarity or something, because the equivalence of these different gauges where the different things are obvious is no longer true. And so people who go through and break, you know, general covariance or gauge invariance really have things to worry about that they don't typically check, because these, you know, the demonstration of unitarity and covariance of gravitational theory relies in a really fundamental way on these gauge invariance issues. Right, so that was a bit of a detour. So,
are there any gauge choices that don't correspond to the C gauge? You pick a gauge choice that can't.
Oh, there's zillions of gauge. You choose your favorite gauge choice. There's, you know, another one that's often used is axial gauge, because axial gauge is one for which unitary gauge is fine if the masses are non-zero, but if you're doing QCD where the masses are zero, and you want to have, so then none of the gauges I've shown you, it would have been clear that the thing was unitary, that you only have some specific kinds of states. And for electromagnetism too. Then axial gauge, where you make A, Z component of A, zero, is a convenient gauge, because that's one for which you can show that these ghosts completely decouple, so they don't, there it's obvious that the thing is unitary. And another one people talk about is tempo gauge, where you make zero component of A, zero. And those are a little less convenient from the point of view of covariance, because they're explicitly non-covariant, making specific components A. But in each of them, and the Coulomb gauge is another one that you see classically all the time. And they all have kind of particular merits and particular applications which make them sometimes useful, but generically none of them is good for everything. So you have to be able to go back and forth. So we have we've got the lines, the internal lines, the external lines. So then all that's missing are vertices. And so I'm not going to do all the vertices, but you've seen how it works, right? That the someone hands you a terminal Lagrangian, and we wrote them in terms of, we took the standard model Lagrangian and wrote it explicitly in terms of all the physical fields, the physical Higgs, the W's, the Z's, and the mass eigenstates. And these all are assumed to be mass eigenstates because I've given you M's, and I didn't have to explain what those M's were. So what you just take is you take your favorite term in Lagrangian, it has some polynomial in the fields and the derivatives, and you can just read off what is associated with the vertex in one of these graphs. And it's going to have several cases. Some factors are going to come from the coupling constant that went to Lagrangian. Other factors are going to come from the in the same way that we have integrals of momentum for the virtual lines. Remember, we were getting at every vertex that came to us with positions, e to the I kx's everywhere. And when you do an integral over the x, what you end up getting is a delta function of momentum phase saying that all the momentum that needed that line at that point have to add up to zero. So because four momentum is conserved. So if we take the convention that all the momentum in every vertex are going in, then we're going to get a delta function saying delta to the fourth of sum of momenta is zero for each vertex. And there's factors of 2 pi in there coming from the integral over x. Typically, you'll get 2 pi to the fourth delta function from those integrals over, because you're getting really an integral d4x of e to the I kx. And it gives you 2 pi to the fourth from the delta function. And the 2 pi to the fourth is also in the factor of I that you get because of the, I'll come back to it in a second. So let's take a simple example. If we had something like lambda phi cubed, let's say, or let's say Higgs cubed, then that corresponds to a vertex that three Higgs is meeting because of three fields. And so the Feynman rule that would go with that, we'd expect to have a lambda because there's an explicit coupling constant lambda. Another thing that we're all expecting to get is for every vertex, there was a factor of minus I. Right, there's a minus I squared, there's a minus I at the end, so we're going to factor the minus I. That was in the Hamiltonian. In terms of the Lagrangian, which is what, you know, if you think of the, if I take, remember the story of Lorentz invariance was that what we really started off with was the Hamiltonian, but then it was useful to think of it as being minus the Lagrangian, and that wasn't quite right, but the amount by which it wasn't quite right was being canceled by being the statement of these propagators were not actually exact time ordering either. So there's two things that canceled. And what we're always following is actually V is essentially minus the interaction with that. And so the minus I times that minus gives us a factor of plus I for each vertex. So we have a factor of I. There's a 2 pi to the fourth times the delta function. So if this is P1, P2 and P3 all heading in. P1, P2, P3. And this is coming, this factor came from the integral d4x of e to the I px for each, back to each field in that vertex. Then we need the integral over x that was in the action had an integral. We have an integral dt, and then we had v was integral d3x. So those integral d4x's were the integrals that converted those e to the I kx into this. And that's it, I think, for the scaling. So that's right. So the thing is, I think I gave it to you in the standard model. Let me just remind you what the Higgs triple coupling was. It was the h cubed term in the same standard model was minus m squared over 2v h cubed. So in the standard model, minus. I already forgot what the number was. I bet my number would be. Uh, minus m squared over 2v. Remember that. M squared over 2v. So according to this, we should be getting, expecting to get minus. Ah, I know what I forgot. There's a convention, so this is what I forgot to say. Let's say I've written the coefficient of h to the n as the n factorial there. Then the, what we got here was a lambda for, and there's a reason for that I'll come back to. So with that choice, well, let's hit it now. You know, when a particle, a scalar is destroyed by one of these h's, any of the h's will do, right? They're all equally good. They're the same h. They each have a destruction operator. So if I have a particle, a scalar field that's going to be, that's being destroyed by this, it could have been external scalar field or it could have been produced by some other interaction term. There's three terms here. There's actually, let me come back to that. So we have to talk about the number of the combinatorics, the number of ways. We're going to connect these lines up. So there's going to be more than one way of connecting these lines up, which will give you the same graph. Because the scalar field can come in and get destroyed by this vertex, or it could get destroyed by this vertex. Same thing as far as the graph is concerned. And so there'll be many ways to draw the same graph, starting from the same initial lines with the same vertices. And those will give you factors of n factorial from the number of combinations of ways of combining things. And what I'm describing now is one of those things, that there's a field comes in and it's got n fields that can destroy it. It's convenient to normalize out by the 1 over n factorial of the different permutations of these fields that you could have had destroying the particle if all the fields were identical. And so, and the reason it's useful to do that is that it just makes the statement of the rules easy. You could have chosen the Feynman rule over here to be lambda the way I chose, the way I told you originally. But that would mean that later on in the Feynman rules, you'd have to stick in a factor describing the numbers of ways to combine things differently. And then you would have a slightly more cumbersome set of rules, but it'd still be true. So I'm going to give you a convention where if you have an interaction, and more generally, if you had phi 1 to the n 1, phi 2 to the n 2, phi, you know, k to the n k, I would ask for the coefficient to be, have an n 1 factorial, an n 2 factorial, the n k factorial in front of it. And with that choice, the thing I'm going to put in front of here is lambda. So with that choice, so just having said that, what we're looking at here is lambda over 6. And so if lambda over 6 is h squared over 2v, that says that lambda is 3 m h squared over v. So in the standard model, the Feynman rule here would have been 3i m h squared over v. And I can see there's a sign I got to read that right. But with the sign, the story was that I had a factor of I when I used the Lagrangian here, right? And so what I didn't tell you was whether this is the potential or this was the Lagrangian. So if the Lagrangian had been this, then this is what the Feynman rule was, because that's how I got the sign for I. I had a minus I for the S matrix, and then there was a minus sign coming from the Hamiltonian point of the Lagrangian. So that means that I should have said that lambda was a minus this. That's what we've got in the book here.
Factorial should be on the denominator, essentially.
What's that?
The 3 factorial should be on the denominator because that seems like the same thing that H is on the board.
No, so what's happening here is that the whole detour was the lambda 3 factorial. So in the book, what I'm giving you, the rules are being given to you without that factorial. And the bold face number 6 and 24 is exactly that number, the statistical number. This is where my co-author had different conventions I did. He won in a section. He wrote the section. So I might as well actually do what he did then. So it's what I told you is true. You get rules any way you like them, but this is a simple, I guess it's true, this is a simple way to state it. So this would be minus, turn it up, so we can just, and what might have confused you was that in the book it's written, this is this, minus I over 2 is written as minus 3i over 6. And it was written that way because these three factorials are going to go over and they're going to cancel something else down the road. That's kind of why it's sometimes useful to quote the final rules of these factors that are divided out already, because they're going to not appear in the answer anyway, so you might as well keep track of it. And so on. So you take your favorite verdicts, and it's this is straightforward. You just read off what's in the Lagrange, and that's a factor. You've got a factor of I 2 pi to the fourth of a delta function always. And this thing that has appeared here might involve tensor indices, or it might involve spinner indices, depending on the kinds of fields that appear in this vertex. That's, if you had psi bar psi v mu, then you're going to get a mu index here, and you might get a gamma matrix down here. So there'll be something which carries all the indices of the fields that you stripped away that were appearing in this vertex. So those are the, that's the rule of how to associate a factor with everything that's in the graph. So the vertex has a rule for it. Initial state has a rule, internal line has a rule, and external line has a rule. And the idea is that you combine your initial states with your final states in all possible ways, and that will give you some class of graphs which are topologically distinct. Many of the ways you combine these lines to these lines will give you the same graph over and over again. And so the next thing you want to know is how many different ways of combining these things give you the same kind of graph, because that's going to correspond that you're adding them all up to some numerical factor. It's called a statistical factor. It's just the combinatorics of how many ways you get this graph from the given menu of initial and final states and vertices. And then you want to have all the topologically distinct graphs, and then you have to add those things up weighted by the proper statistical factors. So let me state those. Probably should do that here. So, procedure, compute, M, this is the thing, this is not the S matrix. The S matrix has an overall, remember the S matrix was related to M by there's a delta alpha beta. Take the beta S alpha. There could have been a direct term where nothing happens, but then there's a minus 2 pi for curly M. We knew that there was going to be, in the end of the day, some momentum conserving factor, and it was dimension full of these factors. And so the thing I'm going to write down is I'm not going to write down S. I lied. So first thing is you connect the dots, right? Connect the lines. Connect initial particles and vertices in all possible ways. So collect all distinct graphs. So for example,
is there a comparable number of topologically distinct graphs?
total number of distinct graphs, then you can find an order for a base period is here.
Okay.
But you're worried about the convergence of it, right?
Yeah.
Typically, there's actually a simple argument that says that the series doesn't converge. And that's that, so this is an argument by Dyson. And so this is completely a tangent, but it's, so his argument was that, you know, you typically in quantum electrodynamics, doesn't get better than that, right? It's, you compare a theory to experiment and it works at 11 dozen places, it's really great. But you've got some, you know, typical observable is a function of the fine structure constant that they come to as, you know, as C naught, C1 alpha, C2 alpha squared, and so on. And the thing is that, so what Dyson said was that, well, if this was really analytic, so it was something which is that you had a converging series here, then that would mean that this thing, if we imagine going to the complex alpha plane, there'd be some disk around alpha equals zero for which this thing was analytic. And so, so he says, so let's look there. But that would mean that physical properties for very small positive alpha would have to be the same, essentially, as nothing dramatic would happen between positive and negative alpha. But if lots of dramatic things happen if you change the sign of alpha, so that, you know, all the binding energies of the hydrogen atom go are no longer binding. So there's a whole bunch of things that go that are really dramatically physically different for alpha the opposite sign. And he had a clean example of that as a sign that something goes bad when alpha changes the sign. Because, you know, to change the sign of alpha, you're really multiplying E by I, right? Because alpha is E squared over 4 pi. And so you can imagine that things actually physically change a lot if you start making your couple of constants of that theory. And so he gives a very general argument that that whatever's going on, this, you know, zero is a branch point or some very fundamental singular point for things as a function of alpha. And so you never actually ask any things to converge. You're only asking for them to be asymptotic. And if you take the series in field theories where alpha is not, you know, 1/137, then if you look at the convergence of the series, it tends to not converge after a certain point. And so if alpha is 0.1, you know, it might be that you get dependent terms here, and then it starts to not converge. And so the statement is that you know, it's usually stated for an asymptotic series that the difference between the answer and the series goes to zero when alpha goes to zero asymptotically. But for any finite value of alpha, what happens is that the series gets better, 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 but then if alpha is numerically is not going to zero, it's just really 0.1 in real life. And if you add to the 10 terms, then you get a better and better approximation, and beyond that, you can actually get worse. And so in the case of QED, where alpha is a 10 minus 2, you can go to 100 terms, and then and you're always getting better. But in QCD, where, you know, 3 or 4 terms might be good enough.
So I guess my question was thinking, like if you have like in string theory where you have two-dimensional world sheets and stuff.
Yeah.
If you have an arbitrary graph or two arbitrary graphs, you can tell whether or not they're topologically distinct. But in three dimensions or four dimensions, four-dimensional objects, you can't necessarily do that. Can you do that in one dimension with these graphs? Like if you have two
can
graphs.
You classify them?
Yeah.
You can have a level of, you can count the vertices in their loops, and there's things you can. The thing is that you can also, there's a statement, and if I can't tell you what it is off the top of my head, there's a statement as to, for large numbers of vertices, how many, these statistical factors, how do they scale with n? And typically they grow like n factorial, or just for powers of n factorial. So they can tend to be the whole shape of the graph, so then you can kind of. And that's part of why it's not converging. So you get up to very large values of n, and the coefficient in front of this alpha is not. If it had been 1 over n factorial alpha at the end, then you know it's converging nicely. But if it's n factorial alpha again, then your series is pretty steep. And so, you know, whether or not there's a classification of graphs beyond just the labeling the number of links and the. In the same sense that you're thinking about for world sheets,
yeah.
I'm not sure. But everything you need to actually write the graphs down, you do have. So you have lines, you have vertices, you may have facets, which are loops, and then something on your business. So just to illustrate what I mean here is that if you let me just take an example of supposing we had electromagnetism where the electric action is something like E, A mu, Seidberg, gamma mu, psi. And so supposing we're interested in E, E minus, E minus goes to E minus, E minus. So it's like not scattering. So this is kind of name, right? This is somebody's scattering. Motor scattering. Slide can be either way, some Scandinavian thing. So the final states are electrons. Initial states were electrons. The basic vertex has a spin one particle, an electron, and a positron. And you can see the purpose of the arrows is if you have an electron coming along, it can't be destroyed by both of these particles. Unlike the Higgs particle. The Higgs particle we had H cubed. If Higgs is coming along, any one of those H's could destroy it because every H creates the particle and destroys any particle because the particle, any particle is the same. But for electrons, this creates an antiparticle. This creates a particle and destroys an antiparticle. And this destroys a particle and creates an antiparticle. But it's not like this thing creates and destroys particles and creates and destroys antiparticles. So the arrows are keeping track of if an electron's coming in, it can only be destroyed, say, by this one. It can't be destroyed by this one. So the arrow is kind of distinguishing the fact that when a field comes in, it's not equally possible for it to be destroyed with both fields. So we need at least two of these guys. There's no photons in the final state, so we have to have at least two of these guys. Actually, let's do something even simple. Let's just do... Oh, we're starting now. So here's our basic vertex, one. And if we had second order perturbation theory, we'd have two of these guys. And now we're supposed to string them together, right? So it's obvious that these guys, let me draw it this way, these guys clearly had to be strung together that way, there's nothing else we could do. And then it's a question of how many ways we can combine these guys. And externally, given that this is, say, P, this is Q, this is P prime, this is Q prime. So the options are, there are, so let me write the next line and then I do both of them. So multiply by the appropriate statistics factor, as well as the thing that I've erased. Unfortunately, that the nth order term in the S matrix series was minus I to the n over n factorial times the time order product. That n factorial has to be in your rule. So you're supposed to take it, if you have n vertices, you divide by n factorial. N factorial, where n equals 1 over 2. That's where that came from. The statistics factor is how many ways can I combine these lines to get the particular graph I'm talking about. So the best way to kind of keep track of that is to just do an example. So what are the options here, right? So we have this guy can connect to this guy or this guy. So there's two ways to connect the first guy. So let me write the factors again. So what I'm writing here is the factor. So I'm supposed to start off with this 1 over n factorial. So it's 1 over 2 factorial because there's 2 vertices. And then I have two ways of combining. I have two choices for which guy connects to. Once I've done that, the second guy I'm stuck with, so there's no options here. I'm going to assume that I'm never going to draw a graph where the line goes right through. So I'm only going to draw negative graphs here, so let's just... That's to do with the choice of, we could ask for processes where we had 13,000 electrons scattering to 13,000 electrons. Something could happen where two of them scatter and the other ones just go along for the ride. We're not interested in that. I'm interested in processes where everybody is involved. So I'm not going to draw graphs where there's a disconnected line that doesn't do anything. So that's why I didn't allow this one to connect to this one. Say. So now I've got two choices for which way to connect here, but I'm not going to just multiply by two because those give me topologically distinct graphs. So if I combine this way, I've got a graph which is has this form. I have E goes in, cube goes in, and then p prime comes out, q prime comes out. So that's if I go that way. But if I cross them the other way, that gives me a graph which is not the same dependence on momentum as the first one. So I had a kind of graph which I could draw like that. P goes in, q goes in. And the claim that if I evaluate that graph, I'm not going to get the same thing as I get this graph. So it's not like a factor of two involved here, it's just different. And that suggests there's another thing that you have to say here, which I haven't done yet. The three is there's a sign to multiply by minus one for every fermion loop in the graph. And for every time I had to interchange a pair of final state fermions, for interchange a pair of fermions. External. So in this particular case, you can see that whatever the amplitudes I get here, this amplitude is going to correspond to the same thing as this one with P and Q interchanged. And they're fermions. So that means essentially I'm getting a wave function where I've just interchanged the two fermions. The two parts of the state here had to be Fermi statistics. And so there had to be a minus sign in that choice. And that was, well, if you go back to the creation relation operators, that was all built in because the final state would have had an A star for each of the final state fermions. And if you're going to imagine a particle comes along and gets destroyed, you've got another A over here which created that fermion. If I have I create the fermion here, I destroy it over here, and there's no particle state here. This guy could hit this guy, or it could hit this guy, but to get hit this guy, I have to kind of move it past this guy once, and every time I move the operators past each other, I get a minus sign. So to have this guy get destroyed by this guy, there's going to be a sign longer than when this guy gets destroyed by this guy. And that's what happened here, is that the destruction operator here and this one were just being interchanged in the order in which they did things. So there has to be a relevant minus sign to control this. That's what this thing would be. If we had gotten a graph which was of the form, supposing we went to higher orders and we had a graph like that, that loop costs you a minus sign. Because in that case, what's happening is that both this A and this A star were in the vertices somewhere. So we had an A and an A star. And if you follow it through, for the particle to be created and destroyed, how do you see it? So what we would have had for a graph like that, we would have had something like psi bar psi with gamma matrix, psi bar psi with gamma matrix. And we want this guy to creates a particle, gets destroyed by that guy, and then this guy creates another particle, gets destroyed by that guy. And so I need to move this guy past this one, past this one, past this one, so that they both have the same kind of propagator form. And so that involved changing three times the one fermion past another one. So there's an overall, and we always have to do an odd number of times to draw a loop. So that's why there's a minus sign for every internal fermion loop. And so the statistical factors in this case were 1 over n factorial from the n for the graph, and then this 2 was just the number of ways to combine things. And the discussion earlier on about the n factorial here is because when you have bosonic vertices, there's more. In here, I had only one choice as to which field could destroy this guy, but if this had been scalar fields, it would have been different. So let me do a scalar example so you can see how the counting is different. Let's take the case of pi to the 4. L interaction is lambda pi to the 4, and we'll just look at phi, phi goes to phi, phi. So that can happen p, q prime, and I've got, in this case, one vertex. I can have it already at first order, right? So in this case, I'd have the statistical factors would be, it's a first order graph, I have 1 over 1 factorial. And now I start combining things. And so this guy has to get combined to one of these four vertices. So the factor of 4, the next one the first time. Once I've done that, this guy can connect to any one of these four vertices. There's the remaining three vertices. So there's a factor of 3 telling me the number of ways I can do that connection. And then once I've done that, there's two ways in which I can connect this guy up. Two. And then this guy has to join the last one. So you typically get factors of n factorial just from the numbers of ways of combining things. And so in the finite rules I gave you for this, I would have had the vertex would have been I lambda 2 pi to the fourth, p1, p2, p3, if they were all going into the vertex. Here I've actually got 2 going out, 2 going in, so I have to actually write this as being p plus q minus p prime minus p prime. But the way that the standard model thing was written down here was written, instead of writing it as being minus m over 2b, it was written as 3 over 3 factorial b. And that's because if I wrote this vertex as being 4 factorial over lambda divided by 4 factorial, this 4 factorial is going to kill this 4 factorial. So it's useful to think of the Feynman rule as if I had been focusing on the coefficient. And if I'd written this as lambda over 4 factorial, then I would have the answer would have just been 4 with lambda, because the 4 factorial and the Feynman rule would have canceled the 4 factorial coming from the ways I combine things. So it's just, that's another way of saying that it's just, you just have to, the way I'm putting these formulas without writing them as being 1 over 3 factorial, I'm just going to get this factor from the along the right, which just lives there. So the amplitude here would have been, so what am I supposed to do? I'll get a factor of 1 for each external line. That's easy. I get this factor for the vertex times this numerical factor here. So I've got 4 factorial times lambda times I, 2 pi to the 4th, delta to the 4th, p plus q minus p prime minus q prime. And then if I think of that as being minus I, 2 pi to the 4th times curly m times the delta function, that shows you that curly m in this case would have been just minus 4 factorial times lambda. And that's the thing I should now go in and then stick stuff into the formula for the scattering rate. And there's normally a Feynman rule I forget to tell you, so let me just check the amplitude. Draw graphs, draw lines, divide by n factorial. If we had had in this case, if we continued on here, we would have had a delta function here. A delta function here. And we've got integral d4x here. And so that you can see that one of these delta functions does the integral d4x, and we whittle the left one delta function at the end of the day, which is this momentum conservation one in the S matrix. And so one thing you can do is, let me close off with counting on the momentum integral. So how many momentum integrals should I expect to have left? After using all the delta functions. And the answer will be the number of loops. So any tree graph like this, where I've got no loops in the graph, you can see that there was only one delta function left over, and it's the one that was conserving momentum at the end of the day. If we had a graph like this with a loop, then the answer, there's actually 1, 2, 3, 4 delta functions here. There were 1, 2, 3, 4 integrals to do, because each propagator had an integral. So what happened there? Oh yeah. So but one of these, you can't, that makes it sound like you could do all the integrals with a delta function. But that's not right, because one of these delta functions is expressing overall four momentum conservation. So only one fewer of the four. So three of these delta functions you can use to do integrals. And so you're left with one left. So you had four integrals to do. Three can be done with a delta function, and you're left with one integral left, because one delta function is always left over as the momentum function you're conserving one. In general, you have there are I integrals, where I is the number of internal lines. And there are B delta functions, where B is the number of vertices. So there are total of I minus B plus 1 integrals left once the overall conservation of four momentum is factored out. So that overall one is why this is my, the one that's here. There's one integral you can't do with a delta function. Now that's the number of loops of the skies, and why is that? That's because if you have a graph that you can draw on a plane, so for any graph you can draw on a plane, you're basically triangulating the plane. Some sort of you might not be triangles, but you know. So this is a planar graph that I can just. You can always label it by the number of edges. So the number of edges is equal to what I'm calling the number of internal lines. Number of nodes here is what I'm calling the number of vertices. And the number of faces here would be the number of loops, right? Now, anything you can draw on a plane is topologically a disk. So all planar graphs are topologically disks. And there's a famous identity that the Euler number for any triangulation is given by the its edges. It's faces minus edges plus nodes. Either that or it's minuses. So that would be the number of loops minus the number of internal lines plus the number of vertices. And for disk, that's minus one, right? This is the Euler number, topological invariance. So we should be able to. The way to tell is, so there's a disk. So that has three nodes. So V is equal to three. The internal lines and the edges is equal to three. Face is equal to one. So L minus I. Plus V, so V minus I is, this would have been 1, so I've got no further than there's no minus I. Because the answer should have been a disk, and a disk is a number minus 1. The sphere is minus 2, so let's try the sphere. The sphere would be, it's a sphere, right? So it has L is equal to 1, 2, 3, 4. It has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 edges. 1, 2, 3, 4 vertices. So L minus I is minus 2 plus 4 is plus 2. Did I get that wrong again? Oh, that's, yeah, that's minus pi, right? So if I just write pi, it's minus plus minus. I'm having a crisis of conscience whether or not the other number is 2 for a sphere or minus 2 for a sphere. The Euler number is 2 minus the number of handles, right? Here's the topological sphere guy. here's a string provision for that instead. Anyway, the important thing is, it doesn't really make a difference. Important thing is this thing is a topological invariant, and we know what it is for a disk because we just calculated it. So this thing is equal to minus. So this is for a disk. It was L minus I is minus 2 plus 3 is 1. So this is always equal to plus 1 for a planar graph, any planar graph. And so for a non-planar graph, this is the definition of what you mean by the number of loops. So for any graph, define the number of loops by L is equal to I minus V plus 1. And that will always agree for a planar graph is what you think a loop should be. And for a graph that you can't draw on a plane, you didn't know what the hell a loop was anyway, and so this is now telling you what it was. And so you can kind of see that what we got here is L. So that says that if you have a graph with L loops, you'll have L integrations to do. And if you're doing a tree graph, which is defined to be no loops, you're not going to have any integrations to do. And that's all the examples we've been doing so far. So you first hit the problem of integrals when you're doing loops. And the expansion in powers of L is important because if we follow the coupling constant, so let's actually say we follow the coupling constant here, then so the power of D in a graph in QED is going to be, you're going to E to every vertex, right? And then we're going to get 2 pi's for every loop. The 2 pi's came with the delta functions, and 1 over 2 pi's came with the integrals. So for every integral you got left over, you're going to get a 1 over 2 pi to the fourth. So we're going to get 1 over 2 pi to the fourth for every loop. What I want to do is I want to trade V for L and E. So if I have a, so let's say we have, let me just say it. I can write V to the number of external lines and the number of loops. And the way you do that is you use an identity, which is conservation of ends and lines. There's 2 ways of counting the number of ends of a line. So the number of ends, it's either equals twice the number of internal lines, because every internal line has 2 ends, plus 1 times the number of external lines, because each one has 1 end. But it's also equal to the number of vertices times 3 in QED, because every end has to be at a vertex. So that means that there's an identity which says that V is equal to 2i plus E over 3. And if I use that identity here, what you can show is that these e's and the 2 pi's combine into a factor of, there's a factor of e which goes with the number of vertices, external lines. So for a fixed number of external lines, it doesn't care. If you ask how the graphs are compared to one another for fixed numbers of external lines, the e's always appear in the combination of e squared over 4 pi or 16 pi squared times the number of loops. And the way you convert this into loops is through an identity like this, where you then ignore all the things depending only on E, because E is something which is fixed for any particular process. And so that's why the loop expansion is important, because it's the thing that perturbation theory controls. You have to keep all orders in, all graphs that are trivial graphs have to be included if they're fixed order in the coupling constant. And it's when you go past leading order that you start seeing these integrals. So that's why in this class we're focusing on tree-level graphs, because that's leading order perturbation theory. But it's avoiding talking about this issue of doing integrals because of the fact that it happens, you don't get integrals at tree level perturbation theory. And the loop expansion is important because of those two things. It's the thing that counts the integrals, but it's also the thing that's controlled by the smallness of parameters in the Lagrangian graph. It's also the thing that controls the semi-classical expansion. You ask the gauge there as well. So I was going to stop there with Feynman rules. It would be very useful to take an example now that you've calculated using the creation and relation operators, and to redo it with these Feynman rules and see if you get the same answer. But me doing it won't teach you anything, so you should do it. So So when you're doing these things in the homework, feel free to do them with climate rules and again, compare them to what you're getting from the creation correlation operator. That's how you really, to be confident with the rules, you really need to do a couple of examples to see how they're coming about.